You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Was it possible that they heard not? Oh, Almighty God, no, no, they heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. Now again, hark, louder, 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 villains! Dissemble no more! I admit the deed! Tear up the planks! Here! It is the beating of this hideous heart!
Hello and welcome to another episode of City of Man podcast. I am not Coyle Neal, which lets you know that it is probably Halloween time. This year for the Christian Humanist Radio Network crossover, we are talking about the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. With me today is David Grubbs, rhetoric and literature teacher at the Westminster School in Oak Mountain in Birmingham, Alabama. David, how are you doing?
Well, and that's a lot of prepositions to keep straight, so, you know.
I tripped on it once, and that's despite practicing, too. one has to wonder what Poe would say. Also, with us is Matthew Block, editor of the Canadian Lutheran Magazine and communications manager for the International Lutheran Council in Swan River, Manitoba. How are you doing, Matthew?
I'm doing well.
Good deal. And I did not introduce myself except to say who I'm not, which could go on infinitely. that would be a descent into madness, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be appropriate? I am Jordan Poss. I'm a history instructor at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina. I've been a frequent guest with Coyle on City of Man and other shows on the podcast network, and I'm excited to lead this conversation today. So before we get into our particular story, I have a long personal history with Edgar Allan Poe and deep affection for him. I'll just state that at the forefront. But David and Matthew, how and when did y'all discover Poe, and what was that like for you?
Yeah, I think I would have discovered Poe when I was still a child. I think the first story I ever would have read by Poe would have been The Murders in the Rue Morgue. I believe I'd been reading a series of mystery stories, and they've made reference to that book. I had been reading, I think, The Three Investigators, Alfred Hitchcock and The Three Investigators. David might know them, of course, yeah. But they made a reference, I think, to Dupin. So I went and looked up that story, and from there I kind of descended into the madness of Poe, as you say. And as a kid, I definitely remember reading stories like The Pit and the Pendulum, The Cask of Amontillado. Those kind of tales have just always been part of my knowledge of Poe and, of course, The Telltale Heart. What about you, David?
I think my first Poe was probably The Raven. I can't tell you where I encountered it, but that particular poem... I'd never remember not knowing it, so that probably means it has a good claim to be first. Who knows? If there was ever some kind of a Sesame Street parody of it or anything like that, that was probably it. Also, we had, my family had the Childcraft collection of books, which included... some of it included poetry, and I think there might have been some spooky stuff in there. If there was Poe in there, I would have read it. I don't think I knew about him as a mystery author, Matthew, until much later on. I must have missed that in The Three Investigators, but I did pick up on it when I started reading Sherlock Holmes, and in the first Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet. Watson, thinking that he's complimenting Holmes, compares him to Dupin. And Holmes is, you know, greatly affronted because he thinks of the fictional Poe detective as he's a charlatan. He's not really as well grounded as Holmes sees himself. So which I was like, who was he talking about? So, of course, I had to go track him down for that. I read the horror stories. Gosh, I was probably exposed to them in a middle school or high school American Lit survey. I think probably through this story first. I think Telltale Heart is probably what I met first. But I liked it enough to then track down anthologies, and I've got, well, somewhere in a box because, you know, we've moved. I've got all of the poetry and fiction of Edgar Allan Poe. It's not all of the works of Edgar Allan Poe, because if you add in all of his nonfiction periodical work, it would just be stacked to the ceiling. But even just the poetry and the fiction is a big old fat book of tiny print.
Yeah, go ahead, Matthew.
Sorry, I was just going to say, a couple months ago, I just picked up my collected works of Poe and started reading through them again. And yeah, I mean, I've been reading probably one or two stories every couple of days, and it's 850 pages. I'm halfway, three quarters.
Yep. You forget his backlog, you know, with things like X-ing the paragraph.
That one is funny.
Or Hop Frog.
Hop Frog is always the kind of deep cut I always think of. It's always anthologized, and I don't know anybody else who's read it.
I didn't remember that one until my reread this time around, so.
Yeah, I remember liking Hop Frog. Mm-hmm. But that's not what we're talking about today.
No. Well, my experience of Poe squares pretty closely with y'all's. I too just don't ever remember not knowing about The Raven, but I do know where I learned about it, because if y'all remember Tiny Toon's Adventures, they had a Raven. Yes. Where whatever the Tiny Toon's equivalent of Tweety Bird was the one saying nevermore. And, there was a cartoon version of Poe reciting the poem, I believe actually narrated by Vincent Price. And so that really vividly stuck in my mind. And yet somehow I kind of already was aware of who Poe was, even when I first encountered The Raven that way. But this, my first experience really reading the stories, definitely The Telltale Heart was the first one. I remember that very vividly. I had a friend who was a new student at my school who I struck it off with, or hit it off with, and he was telling me about Poe. So I went to my dad's office, and this is the early days of the internet, maybe like 1994, 1995, and I found, you know, some terrible website with like just, you know, courier new versions of all the stories and ran them off. They might have even been on a dot matrix printer. I don't remember for that detail. But I remember when and where I was when I read The Telltale Heart, because as short as this story is, and this is the story that we're talking about today, dear listeners, as short as that story actually is, I mean, I felt like I had been swept into a fantastical psychological epic by the time that I was done reading that, and immediately went back to Yahoo and found more of those stories to print off. Like, I remember reading The Pit and the Pendulum at this time, and a number of others. So thus was my love of Poe born, which has not abated. So we are talking about The Telltale Heart. So if somehow you are not aware of the story or what happens in it, I would recommend going and reading it. You can probably do it in about 5 minutes. Again, I was revisiting it for the first time after several years. I was actually quite surprised how quickly I reread it. And audiobook versions of it usually come in under 15 minutes. So, about The Telltale Heart here. This is a short story, presumably written sometime in 1842, published in January 1843. And a little bit about its provenance, which just is going to tell us a good bit about Poe himself. After writing it, he shopped it around for publication. Poe is, by some metrics, kind of a hack writer. which is why there is so much of his stuff. I believe in the Library of America edition of his complete works, just the volume of his reviews and essays and journalistic pieces is something like 1,400 pages. And that's one volume of two. So he shopped it around, he was just trying to get publication and money wherever he could possibly get it. One of the first places he sent it was to a magazine called the Boston Miscellany. And if only we had more miscellanies today, I think it would be a better place. The world would be a better place. Unfortunately for Poe, and there's no way he didn't know this, of course, the editor of the Boston Miscellany that he sent it to, Poe had once in a review of his novel, or one of his novels, called, quote, an insufferably tedious and dull writer whose style was unworthy of a schoolboy. And the novel was the most inestimable piece of balderdash with which the common sense of the good people of America was ever so openly or so villainously insulted. Then a few years later, Poe sent him the story and asked him to publish it. Unsurprisingly, the Boston Miscellany passes on that. It is finally published in the inaugural, I believe, January 1843 issue of James Russell Lowell's magazine, The Pioneer. And Lowell might be a familiar name to you if you're into 19th century Americana at all, whether Romanticism or Transcendentalism or just New England in general. Lowell and Poe apparently got along well enough. The second issue of the magazine would include the poem Lenore. Poe, we think, earned about $10 for the story. Probably no future royalties on that, just the publication and creative writing game being what it was at that time. And Lowell would go on someday to later describe Poe in a poem as 3/5 genius and 2/5 sheer fudge. So what are we to make of this guy? So David, who is Edgar Allan Poe? What do we need or what should we know about him as we prepare to read or talk about The Tell-Tale Heart?
Well, he's 3/5 genius. What is fudge, by the way? Can we clarify that? Like, I don't know that 19th century term. Is that a naughty? Is that a balderized
word? I believe I have heard older people in my own lifetime say someone was full of fudge. Just their it's nonsense generally. Balderdash,
full
that kind
of
thing.
Full of
yeah, basically.
Something. Okay.
So it's like he's 3/5 genius and 2/5 the opposite of genius. Remember that he was also famous for hoodwinking people with hoax articles published as if they were nonfiction.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, well, you could probably say more.
Common journalistic practice of the day. So, born in 1809. His parents were, itinerant theatrical types, and so he, I guess, had the sort of childhood that you would expect from that. His dad left when he was little. His mom died of an illness, and he ended up being raised by a couple whose last name was Allen. So even though there wasn't a legal adoption, he did incorporate their names. So his parents were the Poes and the folks who took him in after his dad left and his mother died, were the Allens. And so he's Edgar Allan Poe. I don't know, a whole lot of details except that, as a young man, he must have been enough of a talented student that he was able to go to university and eventually to military school. West Point, is that right? And you can probably tell us more about that, Jordan. But the short version is it didn't go well. But he was pretty soon kind of thrown back on his own resources, and the resource that Poe had was generating a lot of rip-snorting prose quickly. So he pretty soon was, you know, making his living selling stories, selling poetry. Pretty soon, also writing criticism, literary book reviews, that sort of thing. And was very prolific in that. At some points in his career, he was also kind of editing and managing his own publications with varying levels of endurance and success there. The whole time he's struggling financially. There's also alcohol is involved in some way, though my understanding is that there are differences on what exactly Poe's problem with alcohol was. Maybe that's something that we can get into as well. He married his cousin Virginia when she was very young, and she also died while still very young. She was 24 when she died. He remarries and the end of his days, there's some questions about his death. I think basically just sort of found delirious and dies of disease or alcohol poisoning or rabies or what. It was election day, and there's some theories are that apparently one of the things to do in Baltimore at the time was to just sort of grab whoever's standing around, fill them full of beer, and march them from pole to pole. And so one of the theories is that Poe got shanghaied on election day and drunk to death. Or while he was out, he picked up some kind of disease just from exposure. In any event, Poe dies, and my understanding is that even after his death, things were strange because the fellow who ended up being his literary executor was also the one who also wrote the biography that really set up Poe as this figure of a raging alcoholic madman, which a lot of people had for a long time. Mm-hmm. I guess it was a case of, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, maybe. where would you fill in that story, Jordan?
One thing is he tried to get remarried. He never succeeded. And
I thought he actually pulled that one off.
No, he apparently popped the question to several different women in about the last year of his life, and it just kept not happening. Which, you know, if you are ever one of those pitiful single guys in college, you know, your heart goes out to him. That's an additional theory about his death, is that he had possibly maybe reached some kind of understanding actually with a childhood sweetheart whose father had gotten her to marry someone else when he left for the University of Virginia, as a teenager. She was now a wealthy widow, which would have been just perfect for his situation in 1849. Right. There's at least one theory, and I might even actually be mixing up a couple of the women he proposed to. But there's at least one theory that on his trip from Richmond to Philadelphia, he was waylaid by some of his potential fiancé's brothers and either beaten or taken on some kind of pub crawl with a view to trying to get him essentially poisoned. Because the impression I have of his drinking is that he was not like a functioning alcoholic, but more like a binge drinker who could go for very, very long stretches sober and then would just fall off the wagon and go on like a week-long bender. And then
Okay.
Profusely apologize to everyone he knew and try to do better. And apparently, as far as we can tell, that might have had some kind of health effects on him later in life, and by late in life, I mean when he was 40. So that it's possible that one more, binge drinking session like that could have been fatal to him. But also the doctors who examined him said he died of, brain swelling. Phrenitis, something like that. And it's entirely possible that that was just a correct, he just picked up a fever somewhere and that was actually a correct diagnosis, but fortunately we'll never know. I think you hit the high points again. He had prolific output. He traveled a lot. He thought of himself as a Virginian because of where he was raised by the Allen family. But the Allens, he had repeated falling outs with his foster father, some of which was apparently provoked by the foster father's second wife, who didn't like Poe. Not to get too far into the Downton Abbey family drama of that. Richmond, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Boston, New York, multiple stays in New York, multiple magazines, working for, writing for, editing, and then working for again magazines like the Southern Literary Messenger, which was a huge deal for a while in the 1840s and 50s. Just that prodigious output where, I mean, he was the people who knew him described him pretty generally as a nice guy, very intelligent, even kind of handsome in sort of a, gothic way. And also one of the hardest working men they'd ever met. They said no matter what time you called on him, he was working on something. Yeah. And that's, that also is reflective of the condition of a lot of writers at the time. I mean, they were, Poe drifted. He just kind of fluttered along what we would maybe nowadays call the poverty line. That reputation was established. So I made it a point to read an excerpt of some of his criticism, because he believed very strongly on principle that you shouldn't go easy on writers just because you agree with them ideologically or because they're Americans. Because Americans at the time had a chip on their shoulder about not having a national literature. So there was kind of this movement to go easy on each other as kind of members of the clique. And Poe's attitude was very much, you got to hold yourself to a high standard if you really want to compete with the British and various other national literatures, which made him lots of enemies. He intentionally picked a fight with Nathaniel Hawthorne, accusing him of plagiarism, for instance. Oh yeah, it's amazing. And the guy who somehow finagled, wangled his way into being Poe's literary executor was a guy with the wonderful moniker of Rufus Griswold, who was a preacher and I think amateur scientific theorist or something. Poe savagely critiqued some of Griswold's writing. Griswold formed a vendetta, but also somehow got close enough to Poe to take over his legacy and kind of try to run it into the ground, which is a real, it's funny on one level, but it is a really villainous piece of character assassination.
Didn't he end up writing the obituary that ended up going out to a lot of national papers? And it ends with, it begins with something like, what does he say? He says, it may surprise people that Edgar Allan Poe is dead, but nobody's going to really care. And that, it's quite a dreadful thing to say.
Oh, it is. Yeah, he had it. That includes a line to the effect of like he had few or no friends.
Yeah,
which is in fact not even remotely true. But
somebody needs to make the Poe movie where Mr. What was his name?
Rufus Griswold.
Yeah, okay, the movie where Rufus Griswold is to him what that one guy is to Amadeus. to Mozart in the Amadeus movie, you know?
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so where it's all about Griswold and how much he hates that young guy with his giant forehead and his tiny mustache.
Mediocrity's everywhere. I heard a low, dull, quick sound. Oh, that's an amazing idea. Well, one of the ways that Griswold established this terrible reputation for Poe, which is still around, I mean, Poe is still primarily known as a horror writer, even though that's a, I think by one count, he wrote maybe six horror stories, again, out of hundreds and hundreds of pages of work. It probably depends on how you define horror, right? Because a lot of his stuff does have at least a foreboding atmosphere, even if it's not, strictly speaking, a horror story. But one of the ways Griswold did that was by implying that in some way Poe's work was autobiographical, right? That he struggled with madness or opium addiction, which I we have lots of evidence about Poe's drinking. I don't think we have any evidence he ever used drugs. I think some people at the time, maybe not Griswold, but others maybe darkly hinted that he had actually killed someone, something like that. So as if he is... So it's as if, you know, the actual narrator of the Telltale Heart was just writing down what happened to him. Hopefully we can all recognize that that is not the case. But before we get into that and we talk about things like unreliable narrators and, you know, the atmosphere and pacing and tone and maybe even compare it to some of Poe's other work, Matthew, can you tell us briefly, it's a brief story, what exactly happens in the Telltale Heart? Let me try that again. Telltale Heart. My accent always wants to run those two together.
Yeah, sure, I can do that. As you say, it's not a very long story. It's only a couple pages in length, so it's not long to read. It begins with the narrator asserting to the reader that he's not a madman, even though he's very, very nervous, I think is what he says. But then he sets the scene for us. He tells us how he lived with this old man who he loved, and who treated him kindly. But this old man has this one of his eyes is pale blue. It has a film over it. And this is something that the narrator has fixated on. It makes him feel terror every time he sees it. It undoes him. And so eventually, after struggling with this for a long time, he decides to himself that he's going to kill the old man and rid himself of the evil eye. But he doesn't treat the old man any differently. In fact, he says he treats him more kindly than he ever had ever in the days leading up to the act. And so what he does is he waits till midnight every night, and then he slowly opens the door to the old man's room and peeks his head in. But he doesn't do this, you know, the way anyone normally would. He spends an hour putting his head through the opening of the door in this slow process, trying to work himself up to kill the old man. And then he slowly will open the lamp just so it lets this little beam of light go onto the man's eye. But every time he does this, the man is sleeping, his eyes closed, and so he can't kill the old man. But on the eighth night, when he's preparing to open the lamp, he accidentally makes a noise, and the old man wakes up and calls out, "Who's there?" But the narrator doesn't make any noise. He stays silent, presumably waiting for the old man to fall asleep. But the old man does not fall asleep. He's aware in the dark that the old man is still sitting bolt upright in bed. And after about an hour, he hears him begin to groan. Not, I think he says, the groan, just a normal groan, but this deep groan of terror, this kind of terror that's been growing on the old man all this time. And eventually... he's still there quietly in the door, but he starts to hear this noise. The narrator hears a noise, and he realizes, or thinks he realizes, that it's the sound of the heartbeat of the old man, and it's getting louder and louder, and he's sure that it's getting so loud that it's going to awaken the neighbors. So he opens the light. It shows the evil eye of the old man. He jumps upon him. He shrieks, then kills him. I think he suffocates him under the bed, is what it says. After the heart goes quiet, he dismembers him carefully in a tub, being careful to make no mess. He puts the body under the floorboards, puts everything back to rights. Not long after this, the police arrive because a neighbor has reported the shriek from the night, but the narrator's not afraid. He knows everything is well hidden. He leads them through the house, and they're satisfied that the old man is just away and that he simply shrieked in his sleep. And because he's feeling very confident, he invites the police to kind of visit in the space where he's actually hidden the body beneath the floorboards. But as time goes on and they're having this conversation, he starts to feel sick, feel pale. And he thinks he starts to hear a noise. And the noise he hears, he eventually realizes, is the beating of the dead man's heart. So he begins to talk louder, faster to cover it up. But it becomes so loud in his ears that he knows the police must hear it. They have to hear it. And since they're just talking normally, he thinks that they must be mocking him. So eventually he breaks down shouting, I admit it, his body's beneath the floor. Here is the beating of his hideous heart. And that's how it ends.
even in summary, it's gripping. It's, you know, if you're listening to this, you probably, hopefully at least know the story in some capacity. That's a really good summary. Excuse me. There's a lot, I think, to talk about here, as short as it is. I think, you know, this is one of those short stories I enjoyed as a kid that has only grown in my estimation, and those are vanishingly few. But as, on a, you know, I don't know how to put this, maybe literary critical level. This story is very frequently anthologized for, say, middle schoolers. My wife has taught it to her eighth graders, for instance, and often used to introduce students to the concept of an unreliable narrator. David, if you want to take this first, mm-hmm. What do you make of the unreliable narrator as a concept, and how well do you think it applies to the Telltale Heart? How far should we trust what he is saying? What do we make of it? What do we make of his, you know, his insistence that he is not mad, despite the clearly, how do I want to put this? Despite the fact that his understanding of what makes him sane does not necessarily align with a normal person's. help us with the idea of the unreliable narrator.
Well, if your wife has taught this to, did you say eighth graders?
Yeah.
I've taught it to 18-year-olds, in freshman composition courses, and for the same sorts of reasons. It's a fantastic story for talking about, how first person narration works. Mm-hmm. The I that narrates a story, that's the pronoun I, not the old man's weird eye. So, you know, more on that in a bit, I guess. But also the notion of narrators who shouldn't be trusted to be telling you the truth, directly or plainly or intentionally. So the point of an unreliable narrator is that the story that they tell is in some way not on the face of it true. And you, as a reader, are meant to see through them in particular ways to another story that is happening. I want to make it, as I always tried to do, make it clear to my students that the unreliable narrator is a literary technique of authors. It is not freedom to construct any old fan theory. All right. Narrators are constructed by authors as the way that readers are presented with the world and the action of the story. And the first person narrator is their way of sort of getting a camera on the scene. But that camera is, you know, it's not an impersonal camera that just happens to be in all the good vantage points. It's that shaky handheld cam. Right, where you know there's a person there and they're present, and it has all the immediacy and all the fragility of the hand cam on the scene. All right, so when you're talking about an unreliable first person narrator, the issue is that this person can't be trusted, but it's in ways that the author is going to reveal to you as the reader, so that you can then read through their unreliability to what is really interesting, the story that the unreliable narrator either cannot discern or is trying to conceal. Narrators can be unreliable for a number of reasons. They might be liars. They might be naive and unable to understand their situation because they lack maturity or the knowledge of the insider, right? So you might have a story in which someone's kind of a fish out of water. They're a foreigner in a strange land, and you, the reader, understand what's happening around them to be dangerous or threatening, but because they don't understand the cultural cues, you're afraid for them. Or in the case of Telltale Heart, your narrator might be insane. They don't see the world in the way that those in, you know, full possession of their faculties do. But usually that madness, the mad of the insane, unreliable narrator, is in some way predictable enough that you can read through it, you can read past it, and you can figure out, okay, what is it, what is actually happening? So with our narrator here, we never figure out who it is. So, I mean, I guess you won't be surprised, gentlemen, when to learn that many of my students who wrote about this story just called the narrator Poe.
Uh-huh.
As if Poe stalked his roommate and hid him under the floor.
Well, who didn't want to do that in college?
It's fair. It's a fair point. So is this narrator unreliable? Well, here's how he starts. True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous, I have been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in hell. How, then, am I mad? I'm not crazy. I can hear things in hell. That proves I'm sane. So, I mean, Poe's not messing around here. This isn't some kind of, you know, weird out there fan theory that this is an unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. When the narrator's first line is, "They sell you, I'm crazy, but I'm not," you should just immediately put on your, but maybe you are, skepticism. And actually, I think that is the key to making sense of the story, because he starts off by talking about how the disease, what disease, I don't know, their theories, but what diseases do they know about in the 19th century that are known for driving someone insane? So this disease has sharpened his senses, especially his sense of hearing. And he thinks that he hears things, all the things in heaven and earth, and even in the underworld. Well, one of the traits, you might say, of this particular narrator's madness is that he thinks that things he hears inside his head are outside his head. So that when we get to the end of the story and he hears the beating of the hideous heart under the floor, is there actually the beating of a hideous heart under the floor? Or is it his own pulse? And he can't tell the difference between what he hears in his head and what's going on outside of him.
That had never occurred to me in all the years of reading the story. That's interesting.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's not as self-evident a reading as I thought it was.
That makes perfect sense, but I had always taken it to be, you know, he is imagining these sounds. I mean,
well, you know, in any way, it's something that's happening in his head, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to think it's, you know, it's his nervousness. When he hears the heavy heartbeat, and he thinks it's the heartbeat of the old man, well, that's also a point in the story where his own excitement and tension is building as he is preparing to spring in for the kill. So, you know, as his own pulse hammers, he assumes it's outside and not inside. So whether it's imagined or whether it's his actual pulse, either way, it's the same. He can't actually discern the difference between the boundaries of his external senses and his internal, so to speak.
And it's his insistence that he's sane, which is the part that really pushes it over the edge.
Yes. Yeah. I don't think anyone reads the rest of this story and goes, well, I don't know, he might be. Though it is fun to imagine that sort of perverse reading where you say, nope, this, all of this actually happened. His eye, really evil. His heart, actually beating. He was a wizard.
You did. Cops actually mocking him.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Well, Matthew, what would you add or detract from that discussion of unreliability on the part of our narrator here?
Oh, I don't think I would really add or change anything there. I mean, the narrator, as you pointed out, it's not that the narrator is lying to us. It's just that the narrator has this skewed perception, the skewed understanding of reality. So the reader has to take everything he says with a grain of salt because obviously, as you say, there's not a heart beating under the floorboards.
What strikes me in, specifically about the narrator's, the not only his constant insistence that he is sane, but also the almost desperate pride he takes in the sagacity with which he approached the crime. I think sagacious or sagacity is a word he uses at least once. The care that he took, it reminds me of, you know, a kind of clinical paranoia. Especially that feeling that everybody is out to get you, that anxiety that all these people behaving normally are actually hostile to you. Which if you've ever even brushed up against that is a terrible feeling. and a kind of obsessive compulsion as well. I've had friends with actual clinical OCD and their descriptions of the things that they fixate on. I mean, they just can't help, right? And I believe it's, you know, in this, near the beginning of the story, right, where he says he you know, when did I get the idea to do this? I can't remember. You know, I don't know. It just kind of happened one day, right? When suddenly this, it is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object there was none, passion there was none. This is, you know, this is a completely irrational crime caused by, you know, this one slightly off kilter physical feature of this elderly man, right? So, you know, this is interesting to me because it does ring true. You know, actually diagnosing the narrator with something is not my goal, but I think one of the great strengths of Poe's fiction, as fantastical and as grotesque as it can be, is that it is always rooted in something that feels real.
Mm-hmm.
And the obsession of the narrator here, and the frantic, fevered tone of, you know, here, you know, let me explain, you know, that kind of attitude, that kind of tone is one of the things I think that really, really distinguishes this, you know, a more graphic and horrible stories that I've read, but that is still convincing, you know, what is it, 180 years later,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
I think it's interesting the way that Poe delves into, well, as you put it, his sagacity, his rationality. Even though he is, you know, even though we're pretty sure that he's mad, all his protestations aside, he does have, there is a method in his madness, you know, there is a kind of logic and a rationality to it. And he isn't just, some kind of a violent beast, right? Which I don't know about, when Poe was, you know, writing in the kind of the first half of the 19th century, but certainly later in the 19th century, the discourse of talking about the criminal mind or the criminal brain was frequently in terms of brutishness or the throwback to the primitive or things of that nature, right?
Mr. Hyde.
Yes, right. So the idea that the violent criminal is the id, just sort of unrestrained violence. But Poe's murderers, and, you know, with Telltale Heart as one of them, Poe's murderers are never that. There's always, there's a rationality to the way that they act, the way that they plan. And in this case, he distinguishes between, the way he felt for the old man and the ultimate purpose for the murder. He had nothing against the old man, but he needed to be free of that eye. And he wants to make that plain. He's a kind of ethical thinker, in that he believes that explaining to you, dear reader, the way that he was under the threat of the eye is a justification for what he's done. Right? You would have done the same thing if that eye had been looking at you, that evil eye. And he's sorry that the old man had to die too, but what choice did he have?
There's something almost Chestertonian about this kind of connection between madness with this narrator and the intensely logical way he tries to approach the problem. Mm-hmm. That idea that, you know, madness isn't to genius close aligned, I think Chesterton was saying, but this idea that mad people, they have very logical minds. Their minds run in perfect logical circles. They're just very tiny circles. Right. And they can get everything to fit in it, but it's a very small circle nonetheless. And so he's very, very logical about how he approaches this. That doesn't make him sane.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Matthew, because I just reread Orthodoxy. And there's a great line that I've just meditated on for years right in the first chapter, which is that, you know, we commonly speak of madmen as having lost their reason, when the reality is that madmen lose everything but their reason. That, you know, that all that they have is rationality. They're not, and when that's all you have, as you put it, your world is very small. And I think that's reflected tonally in the story. I mean, we have no time, place, location. We don't even have any character names. There's exactly one line of dialogue, and it's the very last line of the story. I mean, the entire thing is constructed very tightly, so that, you know, from beginning to end, tonally, stylistically, structurally, it is bringing you very, very directly into the narrator's madness, which I think, again, is part of what really distinguishes and what really sets this apart. And just as a side note, since I mentioned Chesterton, and like I said, Matthew, I'm glad you brought that up. In that same chapter, the very first chapter of Orthodoxy, Chesterton actually mentions Poe, which I had never caught before, despite having read that book a number of times. So if you have not read Orthodoxy and you would like to see the interesting connection Chesterton draws between Poe and morbidity and madness, definitely check that out. So speaking of, you know, that's a pretty natural segue into another question I've got here. A really important concept artistically for Poe was what he called unity of effect. This was the idea that any piece of fiction, any poem even, should have one effect in mind, in the horrible modern word, one impact that you're trying to have on the reader. And so Poe, a couple of times in his nonfiction, describes, you know, aiming at a particular effect and sort of constructing the story backwards to achieve that effect, and then making sure that everything within the story contributes in some way to achieving that effect, so that you don't get, you know, what TV Tropes calls mood whiplash or dramatic tonal shifts or anything to distract from the achievement of that effect. And for that reason, Poe argued that most fiction should be very short, right, so that someone can read it in one sitting and you know, allow the story to work on him continuously that way. either Matthew or David, whichever one of y'all want to lead off on this. With that in mind, what effect do you think Poe is aiming at here? And I think we would agree that it works. any speculation about how it works?
Well, I think part of it is what you're saying. I mean, you could imagine someone telling this story here over the length of a novella or something like this, of how he, you know, has this dislike of the old man's eye and how he plans this out methodically. You could spend chapters talking about all of his planning and things and all of the internal monologue going on in his head, all of the dialogue he has with the old man or the dialogue he has with the police. And it would be a very boring, flat story, because the effect that I think Poe is going for here is really this rising, suffocating sense of terror on the narrator's part. If you try to sustain that type of growing uncomfortable, that growing sense of I need a break, I need to come to some kind of climax, an explosion here. If you try to sustain that too long, it just peters out. You don't get that effect. And so if you keep it with this very tight, very constricted storytelling, it's not like you're missing anything in the story, but he's only telling what he needs to tell in order to gain that effect, that sense of that rising heartbeat in yourself, which the narrator may or may not be hearing in his own ears, that pulse that's pounding. I think that it works well, but I don't know, David, do you think he's aiming for a different kind of effect?
No, I think you've named it, that increasing sense of tension, of being trapped. The story itself is about feeling trapped, feeling under this continued threat, thinking that he'd resolved it at great length, and then realizing that in a certain kind of way, he hasn't escaped. He's escaped the sight only now to be haunted by the sound. He's escaped the eye only now to be haunted by the heart. The tension that rises in you, the reader, is it's cranked up with this, you know, as he plots, as he waits to spring, and then he springs, but now he immediately goes into, and how will he cover it up? Will he be able to cover it up? But no, now we have this uncanny sound, so that by the time you get to that last line, and he's, "Villains," I shrieked, "dissemble no more." By the time he's shrieking at the end, there should be some kind of echoing tension, echoing peak of drama in your own experience as a reader, as one form of tension, one form of dramatic what would you call it, suspense, right? He moves from one kind of suspense to another. Between paragraphs, there's no narrative downtime as you would have in even in a thriller. There's usually some little downtime for characters to kind of digest and process information. But here, there's no downtime. It's cranking the whole time. And by the time he breaks loose at the end, there's something like that, I think, meant to be in the heart of the reader. It reminds me of one of his poems. Well, The Raven does this. By the end of The Raven, the narrator is just shouting at this bird. But even more, his poem "The Bells," which is just maddeningly repetitive, and by the time you get to the end of The Bells, if you're reading it aloud, you're just raving. And so it's an experience of the fiction that's meant to in some way recapitulate in the reader what's going on in the narrator, not just so that you're getting into the character, but literally using the tensions of the structure of the story to create that, that, you know, little moment of, you know, readerly method acting.
And not just in the narrator. I mean, even the narrator sees it in the old man, how he's sitting in that bed for an hour and he's trying to tell himself that it was just, you know, some noise outside, when he knows there's someone in the room. And it just suddenly breaks out in that deep guttural groan of terror. I just love how every single thing in the story plays into that growing suspense, in reflected in different ways. It's really well done.
Yeah, you really couldn't add anything to the story without wrecking it. David, I know on some podcast many, many years ago, you said something about Die Hard, that if you had any more of Die Hard than there is, it would ruin it. Right? It's exactly, it is, you know, formally exactly what it needs to be the best thing it can be. And I think the Telltale Heart is kind of the same thing. And you know, that phrase of Poe's, unity of effect, I think is perfect. I mean, form, style, the plot itself, the way the story is told. I mean, as y'all put it, all works together to create that sense of terror. And I like, I know this might be a controversial opinion on the network, but I love Poe's poetry. I think that he brings a lot of his poetic talents to bear on the story as well. I mean, the suspense is managed rhythmically. I think you could probably scan some of the paragraphs of especially the rising tension, so that you get, you know, long, languid, slow, you know, short voweled kind of or long voweled kind of sentences describing that growing, creeping terror before the kind of staccato eruption of violence as he bursts into the room and flips the bed on the guy, right? There's a very keen sense here of the sound of what he's saying, and even the physical form that the words take as you either hear them in your head or say them out loud. So that I have seen this story performed in kind of one-man shows many times, and you can find really great audio recordings of it. On the way home today, I listened to the one by Christopher Lee, which is really good. I mean, this lends itself to reading, to recitation and performance. I mean, it is a small masterpiece, in every sense of the word, I think. I had us read this, so let's at least bring it in here. Dear listener, you get a kind of bonus story here very briefly. The same year that The Telltale Heart was published, Poe also published the short story, The Black Cat. This is a story that also begins with the narrator assuring the reader that he's not crazy. It's also a story in which the narrator slowly goes crazy and murders someone and hides the body and is betrayed to the police by a suspicious noise. But there are also a lot of, I think, quite interesting differences, and I don't think anybody would disagree that though The Black Cat is good as a piece of terror, The Telltale Heart is just light years better. What happens, maybe briefly recap, The Black Cat, and, you know, how does this cast what Poe achieves in The Telltale Heart into relief?
As I recall, there's the man, he has a black cat, appropriately named Pluto, and in an alcohol-fueled rage one day, he cuts out the cat's eye. He feels guilty about that temporarily, but then decides at one point, because the cat's avoiding him now, he's going to kill the cat. So he hangs it from a tree. That night, his house burns down, but in the ruins, they find the image of a cat on the wall above his bed. Months later, in a bar, he finds another cat, which looks an awful lot like the first one, except this one has a white spot on its stomach. No, it doesn't seem to belong to anyone, so he takes it home. But over time, the white spot on its stomach becomes more and more clearly, or apparently, the image of a noose. So he decides he's going to kill the cat. He takes an axe to kill it, but his wife stops him. And in fury, he kills his wife instead. Then he walls up the body in the wall of the cellar, and everything seems to be okay for a couple of days. The cat seems to have disappeared as well. And eventually the police come by, he leads them through the house again, and he knocks on the wall at one point because he's so confident in the work he's done hiding his foul deed. But when he knocks on the wall, there's the sound of meowing behind the wall because the cat has been ensconced in the wall with the dead body. And so they tear it down and he's, the jig is up, I guess. So
similar, but different. I remember discovering the story, The Black Cat, and as a young reader, just thinking, oh, he's ripping off his own work. But I think he's doing something somewhat different there. David, have you recently reread it?
Not super recently. I'd forgotten that there were two cats, for instance.
I had forgotten that too until I reread it the other night.
I remembered that. He kills the wife. Tries to intervene when he's attacking the cat. He kills the wife. Looking back over it. There's a lot of remorse in this particular story. This is a story in which the narrator, unlike the insane narrator of Telltale Heart, this is a narrator who recognizes that alcohol turns him into another person, essentially, and is trying in his moments of lucidity to escape the effects of what happens when he becomes that other person that alcohol makes him. So it's a different kind of element in there. There's the possible supernatural element of the two cats, which I'd forgotten about. Is that second cat in some sense the return of the first cat?
Even at the beginning of the story, he references a superstition that a black cat is actually a witch in disguise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So both of them, it must have been reading Black Cat that made me go back to Telltale Heart and ask more questions about the old man's eye. Because he refers to it as the old man's evil eye, and he actually puts it in capitals. Wizards, witches, or even ordinary people, if they were hateful enough, could inflict harm upon others with a malicious glance. This is something that many cultures have believed, and they have, and it's very frequent for cultures to have gestures or amulets or other means for averting the harmful, malicious gaze of those who have that evil eye. And one of the things that's notable, and I don't know if you ever struck you, Jordan, but the way that he kills the old man, in the Telltale Heart, he doesn't, just as the man in the black cat seeks to, you know, he hangs the cat, and then he sees the image of the noose, and he talks about how he fears the gallows. There's this, the way that he kills the cat is and then the execution of his wife with the axe, the idea of execution deaths, binding together the black cat. How is the old man killed in the Telltale Heart? Well, it's by smothering, it's by covering him. Killing him is ultimately a way of covering that eye. He has to kill him with the eye not able to see him. And it made me think, frankly, of the way that witches were disposed of in early medieval Iceland. If you read sagas with witches in, if you're an Icelandic Viking trying to get rid of a witch, male or female, you put a bag on over their head before they execute you, because the gaze of the witch in the moment of death is, you know, the worst curse imaginable. And they would also cover the heads of sacred horses before they were sacrificed. So it made me come back to the Telltale Heart and wonder, is the means of death here significant? Is the evil eye here significant? And the way the black cat is explicitly significant, and the gallows is explicitly significant. Hmm. I remember. You reminded me of it with your retelling, Matthew. I'm remembering the role that the black cat made in making me look at Telltale Heart differently.
It's really interesting. Yeah, there's even that. This is not necessarily related to witchcraft, but about trying to ward off some kind of evil via some kind of complicated visual protocol, right? But you know, Ibn Fadlan, that maybe Viking, maybe slightly not funeral that he witnessed in what is nowadays Kazakhstan. At one point of the ceremony, right, they have people walking backwards around things so that they're having to, not see where they're going, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, sight, even the instrument of sight. Imagine the Telltale Heart if he had, strangled the old man, where the old man could look at him, right? That's something I imagine the narrator would not have tolerated.
No. Couldn't
that, that's a really great, yeah, that's a really great insight. Well, one of the things that strikes me the most about the black cat, distinguishing it from the Telltale Heart, well, two things, I guess. One is that the black cat is much longer. It's probably about 2.5 times the length of the Telltale Heart, which is still pretty economical for a piece of short fiction from the 1840s, if you've read much of that. But it takes place over a discernibly long span of time. You get a sense of the passage of years, moves by the narrator and his unnamed wife, the slow descent into the ravages of alcoholism for the narrator, so that, you know, we've actually got a clear cause to what's happening to him. That leads to the second observation, which is that the black cat has a, underneath all the horror trappings, has a pretty clear didactic purpose, right? This is a temperance story. And there's even a kind of theological element to it. I doubt Poe necessarily intended this, but in the Black Cat, he talks about how eventually he was so in the grip of alcohol, he turned toward perverseness, in all caps, which is just doing evil things because they are evil, right? He regrets them as he is doing them, but he just wants to, which made me think of, you know, young Augustine of Hippo and the Pears, doing wrong because it's wrong. That
the
really
sinful
sets,
nature, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and that really sets the narrator of the Black Cat apart from the narrator of the Telltale Heart, because the narrator of the Telltale Heart is, again, so removed from in his understanding of what is and is not right that that's kind of a classic definition of madness, right? And that's, you know, legally something they look for when someone claims insanity, is that they were not incapable of discerning right from wrong. The narrator of the Black Cat definitely could. I really doubt that about the narrator of the Telltale Heart, right? I think having a clear didactic purpose is one of the things that sets the two stories apart, and that's also unusual for Poe. Because I mentioned his beef with Nathaniel Hawthorne. Poe really disliked the Transcendentalists, and Hawthorne in particular, because if you ever heard somebody complain about entertainment getting too political, that was basically Poe's beef with them. So to take it back to the Telltale Heart, is there any kind of lesson in the Telltale Heart, or is it just a story of terror? Is it just about that artistic craft of creating a story, that unity of effect of terror? David?
I have a hard time finding a lesson here. I mean, other than ones that would be completely useless to the narrator, like, like, be sane. one thing that's been, I don't know, maybe this is, certainly this is not Well, I don't know. I don't think it's Poe's purpose for it to make us reconsider what it might be like to be in the throes of an unhealthy obsession. You know, a wholly reality shaping obsession in the way that this narrator is, and to have a kind of sympathy for those who are in that situation. I don't know, maybe it could be helpful in that regard, but I doubt, I don't know that's something I would say that Poe was necessarily doing. I mean, Matthew, can you find something here?
Well, I mean, I don't think Poe is explicitly telling a particular moral here, but at the same time, I don't think Poe is against the idea of there being moral meaning in fiction. He didn't want, you know, straight up allegory where everything just corresponds, but in telling the story of real life, well, real life includes morality and it sometimes disappears. I guess if you were comparing The Telltale Heart to The Black Cat, you could draw a lesson in the sense of evil will eventually be revealed and that justice will be done. That the kind of biblical concept that nothing is hidden that will not be made known. There's nothing secret that will not be coming to light. So you could draw that kind of thing out of these two stories. At the same time, though, I mean, there's a third story, at least in Poe, with, you know, hiding people in the structure of a home, the Cask of Amontillado. And we don't get any indication that the murderer is going to have his evil deeds come to light after he's hidden the fellow in the wall. So, I mean, as I say, I think morality does happen in Poe's writing, but I don't think he constructs the story around the moral, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've been comparing it to The Black Cat, but another story that it made me think of is The Imp of the Perverse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I will not retell because most of it isn't actually a story. Most of it is Poe's narrator, actually even invisible as a character, talking in some kind of a pseudo-philosophical or psychological mode about those impulses that we have that drive us to do those things that we know we oughtn't to do, not only for the sake of morality, but also even just for the sake of self-preservation. You know, what drives us, you know, to look over heights that we know we don't have a head for, and, you know, makes it, you know, makes us imagine jumping. What leads us to do the desperate thing that doesn't get us any benefit and only puts us at risk, you know? That's what he's considering. And then what seems to be this kind of philosophical, psychological speculation slides into, and it was that same imp of the perverse that led me to murder a guy. And I wouldn't have gotten away with it too, had I not become obsessed with keeping the secret until the same perversity that drove him to murder drives him to confess the murder, so that in the end, he is caught and he is convicted. But there's an explicitness in The Imp of the Perverse that isn't in The Telltale Heart.
Yeah.
Right. There's a completely different kind of introspection. But I don't know that I still think there's a kinship there. But if the narrator of The Telltale Heart gives himself away, I don't know that he would be aware that he's giving himself away. He thinks that something else is giving him away. He thinks right. The sound of the heart is giving him away. He's not like the character in The Imp of the Perverse, who instead of externalizing inner processes, is obsessed over those inner processes themselves, to the point where he seems to be utterly out of con- out of control of them. But yeah, that's another one that I would put in here. Not, I think, his finest work. It's kind of hard to get into, I think, as a story, just because it isn't a story until like two thirds of the way through.
That's a good point too. I think what both of y'all are driving at, and what I was going to say a minute ago, is I think there is a morality in Poe. I don't think it's ever, with a few exceptions, the point, right? It's incidental to the events of a particular story. So I mean, and of course you've got exceptions. That was a really good point, Matthew, about the Cask of Amontillado, where you've got somebody who is not crazy doing something as villainous as the narrator of The Black Cat, possibly even more cruel, right? Because that guy's going to starve to death behind the wall. And we have zero sign that he ever gets any kind of comeuppance, right? So this is, you know, it's a question you have to approach with a certain amount of fear and trembling. Well, let me see. We have been going a good long while here. Let's, as much as I would love to go through the rest of Poe's catalog, or even more just about the story, let's go around the horn really quickly. What have we not said about the Telltale Heart that bears saying before we're done? The way I put this in the outline is, what's so great about the story, other than it being ubiquitous in middle school English curricula or, you know, freshman comp curricula? Why is it hung on? Why do people still read it? Why are people still affected by it? Matthew?
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of talked about it already, but it's that growing sense of dread, that wonderful depiction of paranoia in this tale. The idea that no matter what people are saying to your face, they're actually out to get you. The police, they know the truth, and there's this grand conspiracy against you. In our current era, which has so many conspiracy theory-driven ideas out there, I can't help but see a little bit of parallels. The idea of a madman trying to convince you he's sane. I mean, who hasn't experienced at least a little of that in our conspiracy-driven world today? But no, I mean, we've covered, I think, the things that are so crucial about this story, how tight it is as a tale, how it builds that sense of dread so well that it really deserves its place as a fixture in the canon of American literature.
I would agree. And I think it's part of the reason why it's ubiquitous in middle school English curricula is that's the right time for this. That's the right time for this story, when coming maturity in a young person has brought with it a certain degree of introspection, a recognition that the internal life of the self and the ways that it may or may not match up with the ways that other people speak about the world or speak about themselves. It's something that young maturing minds are interested in. And this, the story is, I think good fodder for that time. It's right-sized. I mean, something that we've been talking about is how it's very short and it's very focused. And it is a right-sized piece of literature for being introduced to the short story, the concept of that unified impact. For talking about narrators, it's not just a great route into Poe, it's a great route into literature. And those stories that are doors into literature, I think, should be prized. We should preserve the doors, you know? Because so many, I think so many of the works that, are sometimes held up today as the really meaningful and really valuable, contemporary works of fiction, aren't always the ones that are approachable. And Poe is, not all of Poe is approachable, but this Poe is approachable. I think if we tried to make, you know, 13-year-olds read The Imp of the Perverse, there would be no Poe fans in, you know, 20 years. But if you start with Telltale Heart, you hook them. And there's also something powerful about giving a young person a literary great who they read and realize, I understood and enjoyed this old dead writer's work.
Yes.
I think that's really, really healthy and really, really good for young readers to realize that they can do it. They can bridge that that gap of time and culture and find enjoyment and find pleasure in this old thing. I think many young lovers of old things cut their teeth on Poe and then worked on towards bigger and older things. But Poe as a door, I think, is really important.
That is really excellently put. Yeah, that was definitely my experience. That experience of that discovery that you're describing is just electrifying, right? I mean, it is, like I said, to this day, I can remember as a, you know, 9 or 10 year old where I was and even what the text on the page looked like when I discovered this story. So, I think that's really well put. Just the other day, I was talking with some people about Poe's poetry and, you know, which I value and I think is good for, even teaching poetry, because Poe is a good way in his fiction, some of his fiction and in his poetry, you know, some of his poetry, not all of the same standard, of course, but with things like The Raven or, Annabelle Lee, maybe, or The Conqueror Worm, you know, with its amazing grotesqueness, and stories like The Telltale Heart, if you're trying to teach technique, if you're trying to teach style and, you know, again, the manipulation of rhythm and sound, Poe is obvious enough for a young student to get it and see what he's doing, but skilled enough to keep it interesting and for it, again, to just grow in your estimation over many years, as it has done with me. Matthew, I don't think I can possibly do better than the way you encapsulated it. I mean, this is Poe at the top of his powers in all the ways that we've already described. So I don't think we've said all there is to be said about this story, but I think we've said all we can say today. So thank you all for joining me with us.
You're very welcome. It's a delight to join you gentlemen in conversation on someone that I've loved reading and loved talking about for a really long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Amen and amen. Let me quickly, I've got some, you know, further reading. Read The Telltale Heart if for some reason you've made it to this point of this episode and still haven't. Read The Black Cat. Read some of his other stories. I really like The Pit and the Pendulum and Descent into the Maelstrom, which I think another show on the network is doing this year. If you're interested in what made Poe tick artistically, you can Google around and find essays like The Philosophy of Composition and The Poetic Principle. They are duller, of course, because they're nonfiction and they are him unpacking what he does as an artist, but they can be, if you're interested in what he has to say about his own work, I think they are indispensable. And also, there is a really recent documentary from PBS called Edgar Allan Poe, Buried Alive, which is actually available to watch entirely free on the PBS website. It's really good, really balanced, gives you a really good glimpse of the real man behind all the crazy stories, and I would encourage y'all to watch that. Well, David, Matthew, thanks again for joining me. Thank you, listeners, for listening to this and enjoying Edgar Allan Poe with us. This is Jordan Poss with City of Man, reminding y'all, as incongruous as this may seem in the context of murdering old guys with weird eyes, remember, reminding y'all to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and unto God those things that are God's. Happy Halloween.